This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Hi, I'm Li Xueying, and you're listening to Letter from the Bureau. In this episode, ST's former Thailand correspondent Tan Teng Mei looks back on her 2.5 years based in Bangkok, bookended by COVID-19 protests and the return of former Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. Good to have you on the show, Teng Mei.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, Teng Mei, you recently wrote about the Mor Lam music in Thailand, also known as the rural people music. Do you want to tell us a bit more about it?
Maybe we can listen to a short snippet.
Okay. Can you tell us more about that? What was that about?
Yeah, so we just had a little listen of a short snippet of what Mor Lam is about. So Mor Lam is quite interesting. You know, it's very hard to describe it in one line. You know, firstly, a Mor Lam performance can be as long as 8 hours. It can have skits, it can have song, it can have poetry recitals. But what we just listened to was a song.
Right.
You know, so their songs also, you know, cover the whole range of romance, deceit, you know, anger, you know. So it's really a full performance in itself. And Mor Lam is a bit like what we envision for what Ge Thai is a bit like,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
It's a performance where probably the whole village comes to watch, you know. There's Mor Lam season, which is the cooler months where there's breeze, you know, Thailand is not as hot during the end of the year. And these bands, or these troops actually, some of them are really big, about 300 people, they go on tour for 8 months.
Okay, so, around Thailand or?
Yeah, around Thailand. So,
okay.
They go from anywhere from the north to the south, Bangkok central. Where it really originated from was the northeast of Thailand, which is near the border of Laos. You know, so a bit about the origin of Mor Lam is that it kind of started at the border with Laos. So there's this, it's a shared heritage a bit with Laos. It started from people just telling stories, you know, just this kind of activities after a long day of work. And it eventually got professionalized. It got kind of made into a performance, you know. And I asked some experts how long ago this happened. You know, they're telling me 200 years, 300 years is anybody's guess. You know, so it kind of evolved from there.
Right. And were they singing in Thai or in Laotian?
So most of it is what Thailand would call the Northeast dialect, you know, which we realize is actually Laotian. So that's really where you can see that shared heritage, you know. And if you speak to people from Laos, most of them can speak Thai. And a lot of Laotian words are quite similar to Thai as well. So, you know, there's this whole shared heritage of that area, you know, which is actually very interesting.
The Mekong region, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, and as you mentioned, I thought that it held some parallels to Singapore's Ge Thai culture. You know, the idea of street entertainment where, you know, it is affordable. People come downstairs, come out of their houses to sort of gather together. And it's also a social gathering, right?
Definitely. So, but one thing it differs from Ge Thai is that they are not playing to, you know, the ghosts or whatever. You know, they are really playing to people
that come to empty seats.
Yeah, in fact, it's packed. You know, there's really no way you can squeeze to the front. So the thing is that the interesting part is that it comes with a carnival, you know, comes with food, comes with even pets. And when I was there was like a pig petting pen, you know. It's quite interesting. I've never seen that before. But when I went to Konkan to see this, it's really a whole event, and you can see the whole village or all the residents, you know, do come out for it. And when I spoke to some of them, they said, you know, every year they wait for it,
right?
You know, and every year they really want, some of them stay, you know, for the whole performance, you know. So it's really a family event, a real cultural event for them.
Right, okay. And what kind of role does that play in the society in modern Thailand today?
So I think, in an interesting way, Thailand has always enjoyed, you know, I mean, they've known to, you know, enjoy themselves. You know, they know how to sing, they know how, they have no qualms about, you know, dancing on the street. And that's something I really enjoyed during my time there. And for Molam, what is interesting is that it represents Isan culture.
Mm.
And historically, Isan is actually one of the poorest regions in Thailand. So I have to say, maybe about many decades ago, they were looked down upon.
Mm.
You know, they were seen as people who had no... Firstly, they are quite an entrenched region. They don't have water. You know, right. They don't have access. They right. don't have proper roads, you know, back then. So it's hard to for them to make a living,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there were a lot of farmers, villagers, you know, they were known as being a bit more backward.
Yes.
You know, but that has really changed. And Isan people have come out to work. And those who return do try to revitalize Isan. And for Molam becoming popular in Thailand, it also represents a kind of comeback for Isan.
Mm.
You know, now Isan people are proud, you know, to when yes. they hear Molam playing in the Bangkok bar.
Right,
you
right.
know, and they can say, hey, you know, that's the sound of my hometown.
Right.
You know, and it really represents this change of perceptions, you know. And I think that's something really, really different, you know. When we see the perception of society change, you see that in Molam.
Yes.
And one interesting part is that, you know, for... In the last few months, Thailand has also gotten a new government.
Yes.
And they've been quite big on selling soft power.
Right.
You know, so the definition of soft power is a whole new podcast. But right. They want to use certain elements in their culture to kind of sell Thailand to the world. You know, tell people that Thailand's not just about the beaches and, you know, the sun and the food. You yes. know, there's a lot more.
Indeed.
So for Isan, they've been talking about using more llamas. Their soft power, you know, telling people that you can come on a Molam tour, right. you know. And I think in the last few years, there was this traveling Molam bus. So what happened, it went around Thailand, came to Bangkok. And basically, when you get on the bus, they perform, you know, and they show you like the history of Molam, which for a lot of people, you know, they had not seen it before.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So for visitors, you know, overseas tourists who say go to popular tourist destinations like Bangkok or Chiang Mai, how would they come across Molam, and what are some of the distinctive traits of Molam that will help them know that, okay, I'm listening to this cultural export from Isan?
So it's a bit hard to really categorize Molam, because I think for one thing, to survive, it really had to change. So I think in the past, you know, we could really hear like certain use of, let's say, instruments, certain flutes, certain kind of string instruments that they used to use that were more traditional.
Mm.
But nowadays, a Molam band is, it looks like any normal rock right. band.
Yes.
You know, and not, some bands do retain that more traditional aspect. But I think it's a bit hard to spot and, you know, re-categorize something as Molam. But they do have maybe more modern Molam, which is what we tend to come into contact with in Bangkok.
Right.
You know, even... on a larger scale, you know, the Molam troupe that I visited, you know, they're considered one of the modern Molam bands. But you do have the really traditional ones, you know, who maybe only rely on one person to sing, you know, for an hour or something
okay.
like that. So it's hard to categorize.
Right.
And I think for tourists, the good thing is that in Bangkok, you do have like jazz bars okay. playing Molam, which okay. is quite unusual. So you can get in contact with it. And I think people are, maybe I don't know where jumping on the bandwagon, but I think people do see the importance in, you know, bringing out these cultural yes. elements, and they use it right. as a selling point. So I think nowadays it's more or less easier to come into right. contact with it.
And I think that, yeah. you know, this is a really valuable point you're bringing to the podcast. You just concluded 2.5 years of your posting in Thailand as our Thailand correspondent. And happy to have you back in Singapore, helping to shape our coverage Thanks. Of Southeast Asia. But surely you must miss being out there in Thailand, you know, understanding a society at its very different levels.
So I must admit, it's only been 2 months since I came back, but I do miss reporting. I do miss meeting the various people. And I think in Thailand, I mean, as anyone can guess, it's quite a colourful
yes.
society. I mean, not just politically, but even on the streets, you know, you meet very different people and they come from all sorts of backgrounds. And I had a good time reporting there because I have to say the landscape is quite different. People are more dynamic, and it really trained me better as a better journalist, because I think, you know, one of the important parts in Thailand is it's important to have that people-to-people yes. connection. You know, things don't come as easily. You know, press releases don't just get sent out on the dot.
Yes.
You know? So that's when you really had to make things work. You know, you had to connect the dots. You had to really put yourself in places where you could yes. get the news for your job and meet the right people as well. And I think it didn't, it helped so much, you know, it didn't hurt to know that everything was really quite interesting. You know, even politics is not so straight.
I think the one thing about being based in Thailand is I think you had a very particular vantage point into Southeast Asia. It is actually such a diverse region, but you have also sort of noted some of the parallels between, say, Thailand and Laos. So in the whole Mekong region, so much is going on there. What was one thing during your 2.5 years there that surprised you? Or what do you find out that was, you know, to you very illuminating about Southeast Asia in that region?
Yeah, so I think one, the interesting part of Thailand is that its geographical location, you know, it's in contact with so many other countries. And you kind of see that whole spectrum of issues that it has to deal with. I mean, firstly, its border with Myanmar. You know, its close ties with Cambodia. And then it's also its ties with Laos, you know. And you also had a lot of discussion about, you know, the Chinese high-speed rail that's coming through that region. And you saw that dance that everyone had. I wasn't able to see that connection from Singapore, but I think when you're in right smack in the middle of the region, you see that push and pull. You see how infrastructure comes up and it fits, like, let's say, foreign, like from China. And you see that discussion around it. And that was really illuminating for me. You know, and I think my experience in Thailand taught me that the world is like a puzzle piece, you know. And from Singapore, I think we see things very straight-laced. You know, things are just like that, you know. But when you're there, you kind of see that interesting dynamic. You know, you see that certain countries give in, you see certain countries push back. And like I said, it's a dance.
And it's not a binary situation.
Correct. It's very dynamic. And it helps to really understand the history and where each country comes from.
Yes.
And its current needs and its current... who does it need to please right now? Is it going to election year? You know, is it coming out of a economic crisis? You know, and then it helps you understand that nuance that their leaders have for a meeting.
Yeah. So speaking of elections, your time there did bookend this very tumultuous time in Thai politics, starting with the street protests in 2021 over the COVID-19 policies, and then ending, of course, with the return of the former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat after 15 years in exile. So if I could ask you to just look ahead a bit, where do you see Thai politics heading? You know, of course, we all know about Thaksin. He was hugely popular before the coup in 2006. So is it back to the future with him playing this, you know, huge role, wielding the influence behind the scenes?
I think for some people, they do see it like a circle, you know, like a loop.
Mm.
You know, but I think Thaksin comes back to a very different electorate.
Mm.
You know, this is an electorate that made their desire for change known, although it didn't play out in terms of how the government formed. But I think right now the big question I have is, who is in charge? You know, is it our traditional conservative elite, people like the military, the established bodies in Thailand?
Mm.
Or is it the politically elite, which is people like Thaksin, you know, the different political players? And I think as we go on, we realize it's quite an easy truce, even though on the surface, Thailand has actually come out quite peacefully in terms of the election. No big riots, no. Yeah, you know, it looks peaceful, but it's actually very uneasy. And I think we are also watching carefully to see when will Thaksin step out of what is right now a very passive role that he has. You know, he has spoken about how he just wants to be out the limelight. But it seems like with all these powerful political figures in play, it's a bit hard to see who will really take center stage, because even like Thaksin's daughter, Pei Tong Tan, visited Cambodia, and she is the leader of Per Thai. She met the Prime Minister of Cambodia, you know, Hun Manet.
Yes.
So you're also wondering, wow, you know, that's quite a big person to meet, you know, and then you wonder like, oh, okay, what are the different roles do they play in this government? To say that Khun Setta has also been doing a lot. You know, he's been really jet-setting around the world. You know, so you do wonder in these three figures, how do they balance that power? Because all are quite influential people.
They all have their own power bases, I think.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. So you spoke about the change in the electorate during the time that Thaksin was away. In your years there from 2021, have you observed a certain fundamental shift in Thai society, you know, where some long-held tenets have maybe changed, you know, whether it's about the role of the monarchy or the military's actions in protecting the crown? We did see, you know, how young Thais, students propelled the Move Forward Party to success in the last two elections. And it was partly due to the questioning of such traditional institutions and beliefs.
I think the new thrust of what we see as change now is coming from people asking about Thaksin's return, asking about the justice system, asking about what is his purpose of returning, because especially his own followers in the past, you know, the red shirts who were always very supportive of him. Some of them still are in jail, you know, serving out their time when they were activists. And I think they see that contrast between their leader returning and, you know, not spending a single night in jail.
Yes.
And some who are still waiting, you know, and have remained loyal. So there are quite a few questions about that. So I think, firstly, we do see some loyalists questioning, you know, themselves.
You spoke to some of them yourself, right? Mm. What were they saying to you?
Some of them are torn, you know, so they see that he has helped. And I mean, to his credit, Thaksin's policies, things like the 30 baht healthcare policy, some of them still have an impact on, you know, especially the poor. They go for cancer treatments and only 30 baht, which is like a dollar something for them. And they see that really changing the lives of their family, you know, their own lives. But they see that justice is also being manipulated in a way. And I think they have questions. And I think now it's about, are those questions going to be addressed? You know, are they going to be swept under the rug? And we have a few things that we're also looking out for. So I think like Thailand, I won't say, you know, there's this whole battle about whether Thailand's in economic crisis. But I would say that Thailand is not fulfilling its potential in terms of what its people can do and what its economy can achieve. So I think for people, there's still a lot of worry about bread and butter issues. You know, so I think people are probably weighing, you know, between that bread and butter and ideological questions they have right now. So that's always a tension, I think.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So I think that when you were leaving Thailand at the end of the 2023, you wrote a very heartfelt piece for the series, and you talk about how you returned to Singapore with a souvenir from Thailand. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Oh, you mean my Thai tattoo?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so which is not a real tattoo, just to clarify. I actually got it when I burnt my leg when I was getting off a motorcycle.
Ouch.
So, I mean, if for those who know, you know, you have all these motorcyclists with the orange vest who bring you through traffic. You know, that's really the only way to beat traffic. You know, sometimes the SkyTrain brings you only so far. You know, you need to get into the smaller routes, and that's when you take the motorcycle. So it was quite an interesting experience. I think first for me, I had not taken motorcycles before until I went to Thailand. So when this happened to me, I remember some of my friends around me just said, you know, that's really a noob mistake. You know, but what was comforting was that my Thai friend actually said that she has exactly the same one. So she lifted like her skirt and showed it to me. And I was like, oh, thank God, you know, I'm not the only noob here, right? So she said, actually, it's really common because in Thailand, it's just part and parcel of life.
Yes.
I think, you know, in Singapore, when we don't get as bad jams, we take for granted that the different kind of modes of transport we have. But I think there is like, without the motorcycles, you probably can't get anywhere on time. You know, we have politicians like Pita taking the motorcycle to get to work, you know. So it's part and parcel of daily life, and it's quite telling, I think.
And was it our Indonesia colleague in the bureau in Jakarta who said that she has a similar tattoo?
Yes,
for
riding
a bicycle in Jakarta, right?
Correct. So I think it's quite a nice picture to paint of, you know, when you travel out of Singapore.
Yes.
You know, what the different, sometimes challenges, you know, what are the different kind of daily tasks that you grapple with, that you have to handle. And yeah, I mean, it's nice to know that Alina has one too. I'm not the only noob here, right? Alina
Thanks for coming on the show and for sharing all of these experiences and memories. I'm glad you had a good time in Thailand. You brought a lot to the table in terms of sharing with our readers more about what was going on there. So thank you for that. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap for Letter from the Bureau. If you would like to read Tammy's column, we have a link in our podcast show notes. You will also find a link to other articles in our Letter from the Bureau series.
Send your feedback to podcast@sbh.com.sg. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or within our Straits Times app. Thanks for listening.